All right. I'm going to talk about the splash survey and hierarchical formation of galaxy halos. And I'll try to cover a few different topics, but most of them will be teasers for more extended conversations. So let me start by acknowledging the people whose work I'm up here to talk about. There's a whole bunch of people here. We sort of, the Splash collaboration very appropriately came together, started as small groups working on Andromeda, and sort of accreted onto this, onto what's become a fairly large team now. I've underlined a bunch of young people's names. These are people who are, many of them were or are at UC Santa Cruz, several PhD projects, etc. So I'll also acknowledge people as I present their results. We have a little movie to go with our acronym. And here really is the progression of things I'd like to talk about. So the progressive stages of hierarchical galaxy formation seen from sort of looking back in time, starting from today and looking back in time. So I'll start by talking about some of the survivors. And I won't say very much about the survivors. These are today's dwarf satellites. I know Josh Simon and Marla Jiha are going to talk at some length about the dwarf satellites of the Milky Way. I'll just present just a couple of one or two slides on that topic. And I'll quickly move on to slightly damaged survivors. And these are, in particular, I'll focus on NGC 205 and M32. These are nearby satellites of Andromeda. I'll talk about some photometric and kinematical data. And then I'll talk about some modeling that's going on to try and understand that, the disruption of those two, or the tidal distortion of those two systems. I'll then move on to a system that's even further along in terms of damage. This is a system in Andromeda where the core of the progenitor galaxy hasn't yet been identified, and there's some debate as to whether it even exists. The core may not survive, so this is clearly something that's further along in this tidal disruption process. And then I'll talk about some things that are even less prominent. These are, I like to think of them as the scratches on the face of the cannibal. And we'll talk about some of their statistical properties. And then finally, I'll talk about the cannibal's belly. These are things that have been nicely virialized into the parent galaxy. So this would be the progression of things. At the very end, I'll have time to say something about the tangential motion of Andromeda and constraints on that from our observations.
Why are those scratches on the cannibal and not the
detail of the victim? Whatever you like. Anything that makes you happy, Andy. Yeah. Here we go. So this is probably not the first time you'll see a movie like this, and certainly not the last. This is a simulation, a dark matter simulation from Hiram Madaw and collaborators. This is the so-called Via Lactea simulation. You see time evolution of the dark matter in this phase of the movie, and at redshift zero, this is going to stop magically, right at redshift zero, and then we'll sort of zoom in and out of this dark matter distribution. And this is obviously a theorist's view of our universe. In particular, this is a theorist's view of the environment of a large galaxy like the Milky Way or Andromeda. And you can see as we're zooming in, we are sort of a little over a megaparsec across. And I'll stop this at an appropriate place. And I'll explain what I mean by appropriate. Right about there is about the size of the region we're surveying in the Andromeda Galaxy, a region that's a few hundred kiloparsecs across. So this is a useful, a picture like this might be useful to keep in mind. This is, of course, the dark matter. Unfortunately, my view of the universe, when I go to a telescope and look at the universe, looks nothing like this. It looks more like this, actually. So this is a spectrogram, a raw spectrogram taken with the Deimos spectrograph. These are spectra of 200 stars, and you know, looks nothing like that last simulation. But what the heck? Let's move on anyway. And if we zoom into this, you can see that contrary to what you've been taught in textbooks, spectra actually run vertically. Now this is the first thing you learn. These are little slitlets. Each of these bands represents a slitlet, spectrum of a slitlet, designed to target a particular object in Andromeda, a red giant branch candidate in Andromeda. These little line segments are, of course, night sky emission lines, but hidden in there are, if I can get this to work without blinding myself, Oh, there we go. There we go. Okay, so these vertical streaks here, this is the stellar continuum from some of these objects we've targeted. We take this, and this is, you know, this data set is sort of the backbone of the splash survey, trying to understand, get information out of these spectra. So one of the things we measure is radial velocity, of course, but we also measure from the various absorption lines in this spectrum, we measure line strengths and get a sense of the chemical abundance patterns in this, in these stars. So to move on to the intact satellites, the local group dwarf satellites, I'm going to leave this topic mostly to others, but I just wanted to advertise a couple of results from Evan Kirby's work. Evan's doing his PhD thesis at Santa Cruz, and one of the things he's doing, it sounds absolutely trivial to people who don't work in the field, is he's measuring Fe over H, iron over hydrogen, from iron lines. Now, sounds absolutely trivial, but it's revolutionary in the field, as you might have gathered from some of the earlier talks. So here we go. Here are three stars. These are stars in dwarf satellites of the Milky Way that have metallicities of this one, -2 for this panel here. You're seeing a small segment of the spectrum. This is just a tiny segment of the entire spectrum, and you see highlighted here, four iron lines. And that's an Fe over H of -2.6, I guess. And then if you march to the left there, -3 or so, you could clearly see that the iron lines get weaker. It's not just a single glitch, some noise in our, some bad night sky subtraction that's causing this star to be labeled as Fe over H of -3. All of these iron lines are weaker in this star compared to, say, this one or that one. Now, as a sanity check, one of the things that Evan has done is pointed the world's biggest telescope at really bright stars, globular cluster stars. Now, these are 10th magnitude stars, so why are we wasting tech time on them? Well, I can reassure you these are 5 to 10 minute exposures taken during dusk and dawn as the sky is getting brighter. And with this, Evan has 300 stars in galactic globular clusters, well-known clusters, for which there's high-resolution measurements of the Fe over H, and he gets encouraging agreement using this DMOS spectroscopic setup. To remind you, this DMOS spectroscopic setup is moderate resolution. It's resolving power of about 7,000. Lambda over delta lambda is about 7,000. And it's in the red part of the spectrum, between 6,500 and 9,100 angstroms. So this is not the traditional domain of chemical abundance work. Chemical abundance work is typically done at higher spectral resolution, typically further to the blue, shorter wavelengths. Now, and again, just to illustrate, here is a segment of a globular cluster spectrum, two segments actually. The same spectrum is repeated here. That's what's in black. And overlaid on it in red, very hard to see in this panel, a little bit easier to see in this panel, are synthetic spectra. This one is a synthetic spectrum with an enhanced alpha over iron. This one is one with a solar alpha over iron. And you can clearly see residuals when you pick a solar alpha model compared to the spectrum. Whereas if you take an enhanced alpha, the residuals are close to zero. So this is just to illustrate, even at this moderate resolution, even in the red, there is information about alpha elements in these spectra. And this is really all I'll say about detailed chemical abundances in this talk. Evan can tell you much more about this. So Andromeda satellites have also been some of our favorite targets. And what I want to emphasize in this sort of hazy panel here are the red rectangles. These are dwarf spheroidal satellites of Andromeda. There's about 24 known now. We've been going after them with the Keck telescope and DMOS spectrograph. And if you look at the histograms here, these are five different satellites of Andromeda, AN-14, 10, 1, 2, and 3 here. And we go from having a few tens of stars, few tens of member red giant stars in each system, to several tens, to a few hundred even. So you can do a bunch with their internal kinematics and chemical abundances, and these are the topics of a couple of papers in prep here. So as promised, I'll move on to some of the satellites that are not quite so intact. Here is NGC 205, and this is this image, or rather the imaging study was done by Phil Choi at UC Santa Cruz and published in 2002. The spectroscopic work to follow that up was done by Marla Jiha, and what she did was to get spectra of individual red giant stars, because you can only probe the kinematics from integrated light so far out because the surface brightness drops. But if you go to individual red giant stars, you can probe out to much larger distances, much lower surface brightnesses. So Marla obtained radial velocities for over 700 red giant stars in this satellite of Andromeda. Andromeda is over here. The big cannibal is over here. This is breakfast. If you look at the isophotes, you can see even without this overlay that the best fit ellipses twist at some radius. Okay, so the best fit ellipses have more or less a constant position angle out to a radius of about 5 arc minutes, but beyond that there's a twisting of isophotes. It turns out that this is that same line connecting the lines of nodes of those ellipses, but every dot now represents a star for which a radial velocity has been measured. Now, this is in Marla's paper. Now, what she finds is if you look at the velocity of the radial velocity, mean radial velocity of stars as a function of distance from Andromeda, it looks like it has a nice rotation in the inner parts, but at a certain radius, the sense of the radial velocity relative to the systemic velocity of NGC 205 changes. So there's a reversal in the sign of the rotation curve, if you like. But, you know, this may not be rotation at all. And it turns out that 5 arc minute radius is also where the isophotes start getting twisted. So one of the students at Santa Cruz, Kirsten Howley, has taken these data, the reversal in the sense of the mean velocity as a function of radius, and the photometric data, the twisting of the isophotes, and she's tried to ask what range of orbital parameters or galaxy orientation, dwarf galaxy orientation, if you're dealing with a rotating disk, what range of parameters best fits the data. She's used a somewhat unusual technique. She's used a genetic algorithm. The parameter space to search is very large. She's used a genetic algorithm, and the bottom line, there are a couple of results to highlight here. One of them is it's clear from this kind of search that NGC 205 is, its projected orbit on the sky is from the northwest. And the reason this might be significant is there's a hint of an enhancement in the star count density around Andromeda following this gray line here. This was highlighted by Alan McConaughey in a paper a few years ago. And they speculated that loop might be tidal debris from NGC 205. Well, if you take the results of the genetic algorithm, it seems to rule out any association with this loop and the rest of the data on NGC 205. The other surprising result is NGC 205, to fit the available data, seems to require a very rapid, a high velocity in the tangent plane, in the plane of the sky. And so it's on a close to, it's close to escape, and it's possibly on its first close passage. Again, these are things that would be interesting to confirm with more detailed observational constraints. A couple hundred kilometers per, getting up to 400 kilometers per second. This is Vx squared plus Vy squared, square root of Vx squared plus Vy squared. How does it have much? Yeah, in fact, this is exactly the problem. If it isn't very disturbed on the scale of things, if it gets, Given how close it appears to be to Andromeda, you'd expect it to be even more disrupted. So one way to counter that is to have it whipping through. Yeah, we should talk about this. Okay, so another satellite of Andromeda. So this is NGC 205 up here. This is M31. Here's another galaxy that's been the subject of interest for many years. M32 is an oddball galaxy. It's an example of a compact elliptical. This is a galaxy whose nucleus has been studied in detail, the black hole at its center. What we've decided to do is target stars in the outskirts of this galaxy. This galaxy too, by the way, its outskirts show evidence for tidal distortion. The isophotes beyond a certain radius get elongated, whereas the isophotes in the inner parts are nice and round. So we placed a long slit along the major axis that's sort of lined up with this blue rectangle. But the blue rectangle and the four red rectangles are DMOS multi-slit masks. We target about 200 stars with each of those masks. And I'll just show you a quick snippet from just that blue mask from one of those masks. What you get is something like this. Here's a radial velocity histogram of stars from this one mask in M32. And you can see there's a broad spread of velocities, but there's also a couple of cold components. In particular, you see this cold component at about -180 kilometers per second heliocentric, and that happens to be the systemic velocity of M32. So we think this is M32 right here, a pretty good measure of its velocity dispersion. Mind you, these stars are in the outskirts of M32. And this is nicely complementary to integrated light spectroscopy because, you know, this is getting out to surface brightnesses that are impossible to access at this time with integrated light work. We also see two other components. This is probably M31's disk, and this broad component is some sort of inner spheroid, an extended bulge component. So stay tuned. This is something that we're in the process of working through. Kirsten is leading this effort. So moving on to a more disrupted system, this is what I'm referring to now. What I'm going to talk about next is this giant stream of stars. This was first pointed out by Rodrigo Ibarra in 2001. This particular map is from Mike Irwin and collaborators, 2005. You can see the grayscale of the grayscale is proportional to the surface density of stars in their survey. And you can clearly see this tidal stream. There have been many measurements of this of stars along this tidal stream. Radial velocities, I'll show you a plot in a second. Actually, if I can go back. Yeah. Radial velocities have been measured. Alan McConaughey has used the tip of the red giant branch to measure line of sight distances at various points along this giant stream. We've made measurements of the metallicity distribution of stars in the giant stream as contrasted to the smoother parts of Andromeda. So the conclusion is the southern tip of the stream, sort of near the bottom of this map, appears to have a systemic velocity that's close to Andromeda. So that's probably close to the apocenter point of at least this phase of the orbit. And it's also located well behind Andromeda, whereas this stuff over here, the part that's projected close to Andromeda, is blue-shifted relative to Andromeda. And literally, the stuff is falling into Andromeda from the far side, from the back, from our perspective. And just to give you a sense of this is a plot from Carrie Gilbert's current paper. What you can see is these are fields. These fields over here, in particular, are fields that are in increasing distance from the center of Andromeda. And you can see the cold component is more and more blue shifted the closer you are to Andromeda's center. So, using information like this, Mark Fardo at University of Massachusetts has tried to construct a model that fits the available data. One of the things that Mark noted was if you look at the star count map, these authors had pointed out that there are other features. There are shelves, discontinuities in the star count map. This particular one they dubbed the Northeast Shelf. And if Mark ran an edge filter on this map, and you can see another edge right there. This is the so-called Western Shelf. And what's encouraging is in this case, a spheroidal system, and you throw it into a static potential. Now, this is the M31 potential is treated as static here. The green stuff is stuff that's approaching its pericenter. Red stuff, the red particles are particles that are one pericentric passage ahead of the green material, so one pericentric passage ahead of the giant southern stream. The magenta particles are two pericentric passages ahead, and the blue particles are three pericentric passages ahead. Now, oops, sorry. So going back, you can, Mark finds that you can plausibly associate this stream with the giant southern stream, of course, that's what it's designed for, But you can plausibly say that this northeast shelf is probably material that is literally in a shell, like the shells you see in elliptical galaxies. And, you know, the stuff is just a turnaround over here, whereas some of this material is moving out, some of it is moving back. So if you, and his simulations predict you should see a fourth shell of blue material. And this is in our spectra. We actually see evidence for this. Now, here's a plot of our data. You can see velocity on the y-axis as a function of distance away from Andromeda. And as you march away from Andromeda, the system appears to get colder and colder. This is what you expect for a shell. If you're looking through the body of the shell, you get material moving, could be moving, falling in or moving out. As you approach the edge of the shelf, the stuff is right at turnaround. So this sort of basic hint of a triangular shape here is what Mark predicts for these blue particles. So, yeah.
The shell structure that we're familiar with the giant elliptical is not that strong. So is that really a consequence of the infalling system being
cold,
colloidal, or the near field passage, near nuclear passage, it's scattering the population?
So you clearly need a cold. You clearly need a cold progenitor to provide to produce these very. Exactly. Now, so this particular simulation was done with a sort of a warm satellite. I mean, it's still a small satellite, so it doesn't have a very large velocity dispersion. But to actually fit the details of the observations, in particular, if you look at the giant southern stream here in the simulation, it's symmetric as you cut across it. In the data, it has a sharp edge to one side, not to the other. And to match details like that, Mark needs a That's right. Right, absolutely. No, I guess the only thing here is to say that, you know, we see two shells in this galaxy and we see this giant stream. There's a plausible way to connect all of them to a single event. That's probably the broad message from all of these. That's right. I mean, in fact, the pericenter distance is predicted to be something like a few kiloparsecs, 3 or 4 kiloparsecs only. It's a couple times 10 to the 9. It's a couple of 10 to the 9 solar luminosities, I should say. So, and that's a, there are a couple of ways to get at that. Probably, you know, one of the ways to get at that is if you look at the metallicity distribution of stars in the stream, given the fact that there's a metallicity luminosity relation for dwarf galaxies, you can literally take the mean metallicity of the stream and read off what luminosity you'd expect for a satellite of that metallicity, and you get a couple times 10 to the 9 solar luminosity. Yeah, so other people have. We haven't, obviously, with a static disk potential, you can't. But, you know, Masao Mori and Mike Rich have written a paper where they had a live satellite, and they actually see limited disruption of the very little damage on the disk. So in their simulation, they have a live disk. This one doesn't. Now, this is a more recent version of the giant stream now. The map of the giant stream on the upper left here is a map that Rodrigo Ibarta and collaborators published last year. And you can see the stream there's a giant plume of stuff associated, you know, that may or may not be associated with the stream. In particular, they notice this loop here. And Mark finds that, again, to produce loops like that and to produce sharp edges, you know, this edge of the stream is, you can't see this in the data, but this edge of the stream, the left edge is sharper than the right edge. And to reproduce things like that, Mark has moved towards a cold system, a disk system for the progenitor, that is. And again, you can see some encouraging agreement. You can get loops like this on the minor axis, again, from this one event. One of the things that the authors of this paper pointed out was the core of this the bright part of this, the high surface brightness part of this stream, is metal rich. It's actually more metal rich than the outer parts, or than this debris. And their initial reaction was, since the core is metal rich and these other features are metal poor, they're probably not associated. Now, Mark finds that you can get metallicity gradients like that if you start out with a satellite that has a metallicity gradient. And, you know, these sorts of metallicity gradients that he needs are quite typical for, let's say, a galaxy like M33 or the LMC, where the inner part is metal rich and the outer part is, in the mean, is more metal poor by maybe a factor of 3 or 5. All right. So just to give you the bottom line, these arcs, giant stream and shells may be the result of a single collision event. The stream asymmetry in the transverse direction requires a rotating satellite rather than a dynamically warm system. There are metallicity variations in the debris pattern that can be explained by a single satellite with an intrinsic radial metallicity gradient. And you know, the other encouraging thing is if you can track material that's gone through three pericentric passages, you should have good constraints on the details of the potential, gravitational potential. There's potential for measuring the potential of the cannonball here. All right. So to move on to the last segment, and I'll keep this short, I wanted to present something on substructures that are less prominent than the giant stream. So I'll start by showing you a couple of simulations from Catherine Johnston and James Willock's simulation. So what you see here are three panels, and two different realizations. The left panel in blue, surface brightness maps. And I believe Catherine can correct me. These are 200 kiloparsecs across, or a little more even. 300 kiloparsecs across. So it's very... Oh, okay. All right. Thanks, Brad. Okay. So you've got a metallicity map here. And the main thing I want to highlight is if you look at the metallicity scale here, yellow represents metal rich, green represents metal poor. And I just like to contrast a couple of things here. For example, if you look at this really low surface brightness feature here versus this high surface brightness feature, you can see a stark difference in color. Even colorblind old me can see a big difference between this green and this yellow here. You can also see that, say, between this stream and the stream over here. The faint one is green, the bright one is yellow. So metal-rich streams tend to go hand-in-hand with high surface brightness tidal debris. And this is something that we actually are starting to see in the observations. The reason, and we can learn the reason from the simulations, is the higher surface brightness debris tend to be associated with more luminous dwarf satellites and with more recent accretion events. So luminous satellites tend to be more metal-rich, and more recent accretion events mean the satellite has had more time to self-enrich before it got swallowed. So to quantify this, here are the simulations. Metallicity as a function of surface brightness of the tidal debris, and you can see a correlation here, and we're beginning to see that same sort of correlation on roughly the same scale even in our data. So these are statistical properties. So again, just to emphasize that we are studying a ridiculously large region around Andromeda. And if I were to put a scale on this, this is a radius of 165 kiloparsecs. The Sun, if this were the Milky Way galaxy, the Sun would be at the tip of that arrow. The Sun is very far away from the center of our galaxy compared to the region we're serving. And you know, this kind of study is actually easier done in an external galaxy than in the Milky Way, because we're outside it and you have a global perspective. But it's exceedingly difficult from a different standpoint. We're looking for stars here. You're really looking for needles in a haystack. These stars are extremely rare. There's a lot of foreground stars in the Milky Way that other people strongly care about that we are throwing out because they're foreground contaminants. So we use a bunch of diagnostics. This is actually Carrie Gilbert's thesis. She uses radial velocity. She uses various spectroscopic features. That particular panel on the upper right is the DDO51 band that's sensitive to surface gravity. She uses the sodium doublet at 8200. And then, you know, the strength of the calcium lines, potassium lines, TIO, a whole bunch of things. And it comes up with a sort of a probabilistic approach to this whole thing and saying that of the stars in a given field, how many have a positive likelihood, that is, more likely to be a giant than a dwarf, and how many have a negative likelihood, more likely to be a dwarf than a giant. And you see a reasonable progression in the inner fields here. These fields are at 10 kiloparsecs from Andromeda Center. These are at 30, 60. By the time you get out to 60, you're seeing a substantial foreground population and an Andromeda population. By the time you get out to the outer parts, you've got a handful of stars that have positive likelihoods. Should emphasize, even this handful of stars we see in these outer fields, this field is at 165 kiloparsecs from Andromeda Center. These few stars, in all of these 10 diagnostics, they look like Andromeda giants. Their distribution is better fit by the Andromeda giant population than the foreground population. So we use empirical training sets to decide what giants should look like, what dwarfs should look like, and What we get out of this is the surface brightness profile of Andromeda's halo going out to 165 kiloparsecs. And we see a nice metallicity gradient. The inner parts are metal-rich, the outer parts are metal-poor. So what I'll do now is stop and not talk about the tangential motion, but I can come back to that if people are interested. So let me put up my conclusions here. I didn't get time to discuss this in detail, but it's exceedingly difficult to detect red giants in the outer parts of Andromeda. We are using these detections to study the global structure, the chemical enrichment of Andromeda. Tidal debris from past accretion events can tell us a lot about the accretion history of the system. I didn't get to talk about the bar and bulge near the center. The tidal disruption of satellites is obviously important for feeding the halo, but they're also, satellites are important tracers of Andromeda's potential, and it's interesting to study the properties of these building blocks in their own right. I didn't talk about tangential motion, but I just want to leave you with one thought. If you contemplate the next generation of optical IR telescopes, and I know it's hard to do in this kind of financial climate, but if you can, use your imagination, you're astronomers. If you can, and if you imagine that the next generation of telescopes will be a factor D bigger in terms of linear aperture than the, let's say the current 8 and 10 meter telescopes, then we should get a D squared increase in sensitivity for seeing limited observations. That will get us out to something like resolved stellar populations in the M81 group. And with adaptive optics, we should get out to the Virgo cluster. All right, and I'll stop here. Thank you.
I was just wondering what the constraint was on the mass of M31 from the shells, and is that competitive with the other?
Right. So even though this stuff has been through three pericentric passages, we're still woefully short of observational constraints. So we're trying to measure things like the distances to the shelves, the velocities in the shelves. So far, what Mark has done is taken other completely independent constraints on M31's bulge disk and halo masses, from the rotation curves, from integrated light spectroscopy of the bulge. He's taken a static bulge disk halo model for Andromeda, consistent with the broader cosmological context, but based on fits to existing data. And he hasn't tuned that to this particular system. That's obviously a step you could go along. It turns out it's still a horribly under-constrained problem. There's a lot of play in the internal properties of the satellite, not just in the orbit, but the internal dynamics of the satellite. We have to stop the satellite somewhere. We assume it's completely intact when it starts. Clearly, that's an incorrect assumption.
Yeah. So with the current data, using these things to get an actual constraint on the mass will be not competitive, is what you're saying?
I think we can only make a consistency argument at this stage. But with better data on the shells, I think we actually have a proposal to try and really map out the kinematics of the shells in detail. And that might actually tell you something, because that's sort of looking at a particular phase of one orbit, and that should be interesting.
There's a comparable study that was done by Rodrigo Ibáñez's team, also getting radio velocities along the giant stream. And they do try to derive a mass and a flattening for the halo. And they end up with a mass that's slightly larger than what Wilkinson and Evans quote for M31. But I was wondering if you actually checked that, the velocities that you're getting are similar to theirs.
Our data are quite consistent with Rodrigo's. In fact, that histogram I had, what was lost in the fine print, there was some of those panels actually come from Rodrigo's paper. And so our data, his data set and ours fall along the same general trend. Like I said, I think the problem is, if you look at the error bars on the numbers that Rodrigo got, they're still pretty large.
I just wanted to follow up on Julio's point. So in the Fardo et al. Simulations, you said that there's 10 to the 9 solar luminosities in stars.
A couple of times 10 to the 9.
And I take it the mass-light ratio is actually quite high for the dwarf. So is this satellite approach that you have in the simulation approaching the mass, the stellar mass of the M31 disk?
No. No, it's far from it.
So what is the...
So this particular, we don't have direct constraints on the mass-to-light ratio of the satellite, obviously. This is of the progenitor satellite. We don't have direct constraints on it. It does, if it is what we have are indirect constraints. It looks like it's a rotating system. So it could well be a lake type system. The mass-light ratio need not be very high. So I don't think we should assume that the mass-light ratio is very high for the progenitor.
What did you use in this case? Just so you.
I'm trying to remember. It's a few. It's not it's not tens.
Okay, just as a final comment, I mean, the M31 disk has a large molecular ring, and so there's some evidence that there's been some disturbance. The past people have talked about
right.
this.
Mark is very interested in that, absolutely. You know, the star-forming ring, that could be a ripple from this this passage.
Is there any sign of neutral hydrogen along the streams?
There is hydrogen in that general direction. Leo can tell us more about this, but there's a paper by Brown and Thilker about this. It's a little difficult to separate exactly what's in Andromeda and what's not. I wouldn't
Even
say
when
there's
you know the velocities?
We do know the velocities. There's nothing that is, there's no strong concentration along the giant stream. There appears to be a general bridge between M31 and M33. But as for a specific association with the giant stream, the answer is no. There isn't anything specific with that. But I mean, I think it's okay because this, you know, if you look at the star formation history of the giant stream, which is another piece of information we have, it looks like the giant stream has no stars younger than about 4 or 5 gigayears, whereas the orbital times are much shorter than that. So this system probably lost its gas well before this final fall in.
I was just wanting to make the comment that your result, that a very large fraction of the substructure that you're seeing in the star counts in the halo is due to only one system, is quite similar to what Bell et al. See in the Milky Way, in that it's really only a few systems which is dominated by the Sagittarius dwarf spheroidal that's actually producing the substructure in the halo, so it's only a few.
I think, Rosie, that's true for the highest surface brightness substructure. There seems to be a lot of faint substructure as well.
Other questions?
So it was. It used to be. Well, is it still true though that the halo of M31 is much more metal-rich than the halo of the Milky Way?
And no longer true.
That's no longer true.
No longer true. Okay. What was being called the halo of Andromeda is some sort of inner metal-rich inner spheroid that's denser. Has an exponential cutoff, like a Cirsic profile, but beyond about 30 kiloparsecs, things are dominated by a power law, metal poor, and the preliminary evidence seems to be old population of stars. And you know, this is very similar to the Milky Way. R to the minus 3 profile in three dimensions, all of those things are similar to the Milky Way.
Okay, so first let's thank our speakers for the whole session. So there's a couple of announcements. One